Chapter 50. The Joy of Barobel, the Sorrow of Gilmora. If you want to see a town throw a party, slay a dragon for it sometime. Barobel had gotten the news of the climactic fight almost as soon as it was concluded, thanks to mind-to-mind contact. As soon as the news went out, the grim-faced defenders had erupted into riotous applause and joyous celebration. Not so much that they neglected the defense of the city, there were still goblin bands harassing it daily, but the threat of imminent, concentrated attack on the city was over. More importantly, while the threat of dragon attack was by no means over, we had demonstrated that it wasn't indefensible. And if we downplayed how difficult it had been, I think we can be forgiven. There was the matter of counterintelligence to contend with. We knew for certain that some Gervani shamans had fled the battlefield with bits of snowstone, for instance, and we knew that the substance was essential for dragon slaying. The dead god had to have learned as much himself from the incident. In any case, the cloudy skies over Gilmora and Barobel were free of bat-like wings for several days. After policing the battlefield, arranging for the dead to be buried honorably, if human, or burnt, if Gervani, and moving Telamon's command to his secondary castle, my men and I spent 3 days riding hither and yon across Gilmora, doing our best to chase down Gervani bands or relieve sieges. Twice during that time there were battles where over 1,000 on each side contended, but the Battle of Castle Cambrian was by far the largest engagement of the campaign, even without the dragon. Baron Arathaniel was in his element, leading his gentlemen against the goblins at every opportunity, making friends with the local beleaguered lords, and generally helping re-establish the credibility of House Lensley as a military and political power. That he was using his new friendship and alliance with Mage Lord Minolan the Spellmonger didn't bother me. I didn't hesitate to drop his name when I thought it would do me good. Under his leadership, Sir Gimble and his crew were put into steady service on the field, though they cursed the Baron quietly under their breath at every turn. It didn't seem to bother the old man. Pentandra, of course, quitted the field as soon as she was able, and escorted a large party of wounded who could be moved back to temples staged as field hospitals back in Barobel. She was already busy sending word of our victory to everyone she could, in order to spread the novel idea that we knew what the hell we were doing. According to her, in conjunction with our new Alka-Alon allies, the Arcane Orders and the Spellmonger had engineered a surprise counterattack that had daringly driven the Gervani away from the city, and had just happened to slay a dragon that had gotten in our way. She entirely underplayed the dragon-slaying part, which I thought was the most important, but she set me straight. "If we act like it's a big deal, so will Rad," she explained, the day before she left for Barobel. "Rad made it a big deal at Coronation. So if we take this and toss it back to him and say, 'Yeah, we did that. What else do you have?' then everyone will feel a hell of a lot safer." Everyone except me, who knows just how damn hard it was for the combined might of the Arcane Orders to do more than put a dent in that damn thing, I reminded her. "Try not to mention that too much," she counseled me. "That kind of undermines what I'm trying to do for us here." "What are you trying to do for us?" I asked. I thought I had been doing all the doing in this battle. She looked at me, amused.
"I'm trying to capitalize on your success," she finally said.
"I'm trying to promote the Arcane Orders as the saviors of the kingdom, the cornerstone upon which the throne rests. I'm trying to improve our image, which the Censorate has been doing its best to sully. I'm reaching out to the common folk as their savior, and the nobility as their solution. I'm playing off regional political powers against centralized political authority, and I'm trying to get the common people enthusiastic about supporting the new magical regime."
"I just fought a dragon," I pointed out weakly.
"So did all your friends," she dismissed. "I just got us free lodgings in Barobel, when you decide to join us," she shot back. So we didn't act like slaying a dragon was a big deal, officially. Unofficially, the people of Gilmora were ecstatic. The springtime raid from the sky, which had demolished or incapacitated 5 garrisoned castles, had dispirited the Gilmorans. Hearing about a dead dragon did wonders for morale. Gilmora, in general, was a shambles.
After spending 4 days touring the once prosperous territory in its defence, I was depressed about the prospects for its recovery. As long as the goblins continued to harass, there wouldn't be cotton or tobacco or floon or indigo moving downriver. It takes a fairly sophisticated infrastructure to produce cotton, for instance, and with most of the peasantry more concerned about fighting for their lives than showing up for work, it was unlikely they would be returning to the fields any time soon. After the Battle of Castle Cambrian, however, the Gavanni did their best to avoid meeting us on the field in pitched battle. Despite their innovations in cavalry, most of their forces were still light infantry. Most, but not all. Tarrant bade me to visit him at a remote farmstead a few miles off the Great Cotton Road 3 days after we'd slain the dragon. That's where he lectured me on the evolution of Gavanni weapons and tactics. And Gavanni. "This is the standard pre-war Gervan," he said, lifting a tarpaulin from over a freshly killed specimen. "You'll note the short stature, the black hair, the piggy little eyes. Armed with a club and a shield, he's a raider, not much else. One of the rural tribes recruited for shock troops, I'm guessing." "This," he said, rolling the tarp back more and revealing a second corpse, better armoured than the first, "is what happens when you take a standard Gervan and outfit him for war. A light chain or leather shirt, iron or leather helmet, sword or axe or spear instead of a club. Much deadlier, harder to kill, but no stronger or larger than the tribesmen. This is who the dead god is using as his backbone troops, guards and regular infantry. Then there are the hobs," he said, rolling the tarp back even further. The next goblin corpse was fully 6 inches taller than its mates. The black hair was gone, revealing a well-muscled but wiry dark skin underneath. "These are the ones the dead god took as cubs and castrated. These are his best heavy infantry now. Once they're hobbed, the Gavanni grow larger, have more strength, and are much more of a match for your average infantryman. They might be more docile than the unaugmented tribes, but not to us. We also think they are being controlled partially through some drug or narcotic. There's a distinctive smell about these hobgoblins compared to the tribals. Finally, we have this. This is new," he said simply, and unfurled the tarp completely. The last figure was similar to the third, but was another 6 inches or more taller. Indeed, it looked like a lantern-jawed, bow-legged shadow of a man, not a goblin. There was no hair, and the Gervan was tattooed around the face and hands in a ghastly white dye. "It looks like a hobgoblin," I shrugged. "Ah, that's what I thought too," he nodded, "but then I looked more closely. These aren't hobs, Min. They're intact. They can breed." It took a moment or two for that implication to sink in. "What? They can breed? They can," he nodded. "I wasn't sure either, so I did some tests. Somehow the bastard in the big green ball figured out how to grow them bigger. This was the biggest one I found, but more than a quarter of the hobs I inspected in the field were actually from this variety. It's wearing livery, too," I noted. The goblin's leather armour had been overpainted in red ochre in a variety of Gavanni writing I couldn't decipher, but there was a central motif involving a severed hand. "Blood letters?" I asked. The thaumaturge nodded. "Right. A regular Gavanni tribe, not just a drone in the warrior society. Big, mean, nasty, and big. As big as a man, almost. And if he can make them this big, he can make them even bigger," I said with a depressed sigh. "How long before they're tilting with us on the field like gentlemen?" "Not in our lifetime, I'd wager," Tarrant agreed, after a moment's consideration. "They might be large enough to ride a horse, but that's something else again than riding in armour and then fighting from horseback. But this doesn't bode well, Min. One of the biggest advantages we have is our size. If they can match us in that, this war just got a lot harder to win." "They have dragons," I dismissed. "A new improved goblin isn't concerning me so much." "It should," he said, shaking his head. "Our intelligence indicates that Sherul has less than a dozen dragons at the moment. He has hundreds of thousands of Gavanni, and only a third of his total force is invading Gilmora at the moment. The rest are guarding his dark realm, overseeing the fields the soulless tend, skirmishing with our northern command, or training, Training? I asked, surprised. Training, Taran confirmed. Training under human officers, about human tactics and human weaknesses. Mostly soulless, but some have signed on with the dead god for gold. Or Irionite. What? I asked, alarmed. He's giving it freely to humans now. A rumour, so far, no more, Taran admitted. But it is concerning. If humans are freely signing on with the foe of all humanity. We all shook our heads at that prospect. So this is what the future holds, Taran finished, recovering the corpses. Larger Gavani, trained to fight and armour themselves like humans, and more of the same. And for all our valiant struggle, this year we have lost hundreds of square miles to the foe, and scores of estates have been rendered useless or fallen into darkness. And yet the struggle for Gilmara continues, Mavone pointed out. There's still 50,000 or 60,000 Gervani in the region and more on the way. There are thousands of humans fighting for their lives against them. If we can prevent Barobel from falling until King Rad arrives with his reinforcements, we may at least be able to preserve the southern baronies. Through the winter, he added. Gilmora accounts for more than a third of Castol's revenue, Taran pointed out. Losing it would be devastating to Rad. Gilmora accounts for less than a fifth of the kingdom of Castal Shah's revenue, I pointed out. While that's still significant, it isn't the blow it was. Losing Gilmora will hurt the coffers, but it will hurt the levies more. It would be most strategically prudent to abandon the region, Taran said dispassionately. We aren't abandoning Gilmora, Mavone said flatly. He was from here. This was his home. We can't afford to abandon Gilmora, and not just for the money. If we let the goblins get a toehold in the Riverlands, next year will be twice as bad. They won't stop at Barobel. They'll be besieging lands, Garwood, the lazy river fiefs, even Castabriel itself. Gilmora is to be our laboratory, where we discover the best way to fight them and beat them. The dead god builds his strength and trains. We should do likewise. But men... We've poured in over 60,000 men, and the province is still just as invaded as it was last spring, Taran pointed out. What happens if they move their strength in a different direction? Perhaps make for the coastal regions of Alshar or try retaking the Mage Lands? Then we move all of our people around to face him. But he won't. He wants Gilmora. He needs Gilmora, I emphasized. That drew a curious look from Baron Arathaniel. Does the beastie have a preference for cotton? He has a taste for human sacrifice, I said darkly. Gilmora is one of the most densely populated lands, until you reach the coastal cities. He's already sent back thousands of victims for sacrifice in coffles over a mile long. Oh, the Baron said, his face blanching. Not all war is as clean and neat as our victory over the warbird this summer, I pointed out. In this struggle, every human life needs to have value to us, because every human life is valuable to Shirul. Everyone he puts to the knife expands his realm just a little more. Everyone who takes his foul pledge slays five of their fellow men for the privilege of being his field slave. If Shirul sees our people as resources to be harvested, then we must see them likewise, or we lose this war. 5 days of day and night running raids, bitter fighting in the bush, and relief of local manners in distress was enough. I was exhausted, as were most of my men, and the local situation was stable, more or less. When we couldn't find a band larger than 50 strong south of Renvor, I quit the field. Telemann, freshly restored after a 2-day mandatory leave I'd ordered him to take, was firmly in control of the countryside. Commanding from his new, smaller but more defensible command post, he had 50 lance-strong patrols screening for any more large bands approaching Barobel, and a team of 3 high magi scrying the region continuously. So I took a break. I gathered the warriors of my household, after seeing to the supply of my brave Bovali, who were encamped in the ruins of Cambrian village, guarding the slowly rotting corpse of the dragon, which continued to resist magic even in death. The body had to be seeded with snowstone to get the most basic of preservation spells to work. The Bovali were in good spirits, despite the dead, Over 200 of my people would not be returning to their happy little valley, including some I would miss. Ancient Vren of the Dyke Tower Watch had fallen in battle, as had my wise yeoman Lois the Shepherd, Gorka the Guard, and Headman Brandine of Gurisham. The survivors were in good morale otherwise. After the rain had broken and things had dried up, they had re-inhabited the ruined village and made it into a camp of sorts, under Saronsil's leadership. The Bovali's bloodlust against the Gavani was temporarily satisfied, I saw, as the road leading to Cambrian was fenced on both sides with stakes, sticks, and spears, each bearing a goblin's head. The bodies had been incinerated by Rondal and Tyndall in a ghastly, magical pyre, and the great black stain of the site next to the dragon was now a vast field of bone and ash. The Sevendori, as they all insisted they be called now, were also insistent I stay the night and drink with them. Baron Arathaniel had graciously sent 4 barrels of fine Gilmoran wine from a manor he'd liberated back to my people, and I couldn't rightly say no. The magical cord and I got knee-walking drunk that night, and ended the evening by prying 2 dozen of the dragon's lesser teeth out of its maw for distribution as prizes of the campaign to worthy warriors. The next morning, my entourage and I quit the ruined village, promising to return soon, and rode south down the great cotton road with a dragon-sized hangover. Barrowbell was a 2-day journey along the highway. After camping at a burned-out stable, we entered the city near twilight the next day, to the roar of cheering crowds. I don't know who arranged it, or if it was just a spontaneous celebration. Pentandra was laconic on the matter when I asked her mind to mind. She just told me to change into the clothes she had prepared for me when I came to her maidservant Latra, who was waiting by the gate. When we approached the northernmost outpost, we were greeted by a delegation of city militiamen and officials, all bearing the light blue tabard and the cotton bowl and bell device of Barrowbell in white. From there, we were given an honor guard and escorted into the city proper, where thousands waited. We were showered with flower petals, and strange women emerged from the crowd to kiss us, and little girls gave us bouquets. It was all quite overwhelming. I wasn't sure where exactly we were going until one of the officials, I think he was the master of the borough or something like that, led us to a wooden platform that had been erected on the plaza in front of the cotton market. Sitting on the dais was Pentandra, Planus, Mavone, Asterol, who had just arrived from some business in the south, and a few other noteworthy magi, 5 or 6 poshly dressed members of the clergy, a young, earnest-looking man in rich armour, who was apparently the chief of the city's defences, some burghers, local lords, and a well-rested-looking Sire Kay in newly fashioned finery. He smiled nervously at me when I achieved the stage. Someone put a cup in my hand. The roar of the crowd was deafening. There were at least 5,000 people around the square as I mounted the platform, bowing and waving and generally being intoxicated from the adulation. The crowd had a different feel to it than the masses at the coronation festivities in Castabriel. These people were celebrating being alive, not Rard's change in headgear. The difference was enough to make me uncomfortable. I wasn't the only one. Sire Kay looked positively embarrassed. That, if nothing else, allowed me to regain my composure. The cries for me to speak became overwhelming, and when I could ignore them no longer, I cast an amplification spell that made my voice audible to everyone. "People of Barrowbell," I shouted, "you have been protected from the dragon and the dead god." The crowd roared in gratitude. I continued, "I am Mage Lord Minilan of Sevendor. I am Marshal of Castal and Alsha, Lord of Sevendor, and Head of the Arcane Orders. But most of you know me just as the Spellmonger." Ever had thousands of people go insane with enthusiasm at the mere mention of your name? That's a heady wine to taste. But I have a fondness for heady wine. I continued, "While the war rages on and great sacrifice lies before us, we can take a moment to savor a victory. The dead god set his sights on Barrowbell, and he has been denied." More wild cheers. The dead god had become a horrific spectre in local folklore in the last year, as refugees from the wilderlands brought tales from the terrors of the penumbra and worse. I had done my best to fuel these tales, encouraging minstrels and jongleurs to compose stories and songs, saying as much. I was glad to see it was working. You gather here today to bid welcome and honour to the heroes who fought, fell, and defended you. Burn a candle for the noble dead in the days to come, but join me in honouring the two heroes instrumental in our victory. The first may surprise you, but without her, we would not have won. Please help me honour Lenadara of Westwood. I don't know what they were expecting, but when my adorable, shy new apprentice was thrust forward, dressed in a new gown of Westwood green, a sash with the Seven-Dory snowflake device on it, and a slender short sword to give her a martial presentation, they went even wilder. She might be slight in stature, but this young lady wielded the magic blade that mortally wounded the dragon. Destined to be a powerful mage in her own right, her bravery and her cunning tipped the scales in battle. For this honour, I award to her one of the two greatest fangs from the worm. I gestured to Tyndall and Rondell, who had carefully extracted the largest two teeth from the dragon and preserved them. I figured the symbolism was appropriate. We'd want to study the teeth, of course, but as symbols of victory you cannot beat the sight of a two-foot-long, savagely curved dragon tooth. Lenadara took it from her two senior apprentices awkwardly, and caressed the well-cleaned edge of the incisor carefully, before grasping it firmly in both hands, turning to face the crowd, and hoisting it as high over her head as she could. The lass had tears in her eyes, a strange mix of emotions on her face. The crowd loved it. But this apprentice mage was not the only hero in the tale, for the beast did not fall until the bravest knight I know took up his lance and charged the beast as it lay wounded. And with the gods guiding his hands, he slew the beast with one mighty blow. More cheers. Everyone loves an underdog's success. This brave knight had already won, by his skill at arms, not just fame, fortune, lands, and the hand of a beautiful noblewoman. He cowed the fiercest of his foes on the list field that they withdrew in his favour, rather than face his wrath. A bit of a simplification, but I didn't mind. Legend thrives on simplicity. When I gave him the task of fighting the beast single-handedly, he did not cower. He did not promise victory. He did not plead for me to find another. When tasked with this mission, this brave knight put his helmet on, took up his lance, and charged the dragon because it was his noble duty to do so. People of Barrowbell, may I present to you your saviour, the hero of Cambrian Castle, Sire Kay of Sevendore, the Dragon Slayer. I wasn't intending on branding the man a legend. I was just using the opportunity to tease him, get under his skin a little, by putting him in an awkward situation, as men do to one another in their sadistic displays of affection. But his stern face, bisected by that bushy moustache, and that tall, powerfully built body, seemed to enchant the people of Barrowbell. None of the commotion they had raised previously could compare with the roar of adulation that erupted when Sire Kay stood. Therefore it is only right and fitting that this brave knight be rewarded with the left fang of the dragon, a simple country knight, alone on his horse, charging a wounded and dangerous beast a dozen times the size of his horse. Let the dead god hear of his deed and despair. The joy and relief that came out of the crowd was palpable. For weeks, months even, they had been disturbed and alarmed by the invasion at their doorstep. Most had sent their loved ones away south, if they could, or taken to the famed roads of Barrowbell themselves for the last time. The people who remained were stalwart, either too poor or too proud or too invested in their famed city to abandon it defenceless. These were the people who loved their city as I loved Sevendore. After all they had suffered and worried about, giving them a hero and hope, combined in one man, was the least I could do. And Sire Kay's dignity was a small price to pay for it. The man looked stone-faced as he accepted the fang from my boys, and he took Dara's side before he held it aloft one-handed. Dara joined him a moment later, and the volume went up more than I thought possible. "I will not forget this, Minolan," Sire Kay said in an undertone as he passed by me on the way back to his seat. I was almost too startled to reply. That was the first time I could recall Sire Kay addressing me informally by my name. "Oh, relax, Kay," I whispered back. "I just ensured you will never have to pay for another drink again in your life." There were more speeches and even a few prayers from the Sky Father of the Burg before the crowd dispersed, and we were led to the inevitable post-ceremony reception. Everyone wanted to shake Sire Kay's hand, be introduced to him, and learn the story of his life. Likewise, Dara was so consumed by admirers that I had to have one of her Duer uncles stand behind her shoulder while she received them. Having her bird on the other shoulder almost ruined the move, however, as the Gilmorans are mad for hawking, and the silver-hooded raptor is rare this far west. "That was nobly done, Mage Lord," Planner said as he handed me a glass of wine. "Many would have sought to take the credit for the battle and the victory solely for themselves." "I have enough notoriety," I pointed out, "and enough enemies." "Success attracts them," he agreed, "but still—"
"Oh, don't let him fool you, Planus," Asterol drawled as he wandered over. "Minolan did it for purely selfish reasons, didn't you?"
"Well, yes," I conceded quietly. "I've had all the glory I need, thank you very much. It leads to paperwork, which is hardly glorious. This way the attention goes to others, which leaves me more time for paperwork."
"He's avoiding attention on purpose," Pentandra explained helpfully. "If he's shaking everyone's hand and giving out his blessing and kissing babies and such, he can't get real work done. Not that Kay and Dara weren't deserving of honors, but the people were chanting Spellmonger when he entered the ceremony, and chanting Dragonslayer, Hawkmaid, on the way out. Hardly anyone even remembers the poor Spellmonger now. He has given them more colourful heroes, and yes, that is just the selfish reason he did it." Penny was drinking a little more than usual, but I couldn't say it was a bad thing. Between the battle and the politics, she looked worn. She needed to relax a bit, and have a couple of drinks and maybe a farm boy.
"Regardless, his performance was just what the city needed," Asteral agreed. "This was my home base back when I was a freelance war mage. This is my town, so to speak. As festive as it appears right now, it's half deserted, dispirited, and its people are terrified. Giving them a hero, two heroes, so engaging, was a cunning maneuver."
"That implies that there is something toward which I'm maneuvering," I said, sipping my wine patiently. "What do you think that might be?"
"I'm hoping it's something big, expensive and royal," Mavone offered.
"That would be wise," nodded Asterol, "because His Majesty will be here within days with an army for the relief of Gilmara. It took long enough, but he will be here with the first barge loads, some 2,000 heavy lancers, with infantry and artillery following. If you're going to beg a boon from him, right after you've slain a dragon and rescued a key city, might be a good time."
"Do we need anything?" asked Mavone curiously. "We still haven't taken possession of the installations we were given at coronation. There are parts of the kingdom where the censors still haven't heard about the lifting of the bans, or the establishment of the kingdom, for that matter. But Asterol is correct. If we did want something, this would be a good leverage point. This should add much to our metaphorical treasury with the realm. Best we put it to good use. What does the Order need? And what royal reward for these two heroes?" I frowned. "You make it sound so sordid. I just wanted the credit to go where it should."
"Which is uncommonly noble for a nobleman," Planus pointed out. "I am no mere nobleman," I observed. "I'm a mage lord. I'm the mage lord, if you want to be technical. I've tried to set a higher standard of conduct for my peers, I suppose, just to keep us from being viewed the way many of the nobility are. I want the arcane nobility to be better, I guess," I admitted. "It's probably just a conceit of mine, for I have found no real correlation between talent and honour, but I hope if I set the right tone,
and demonstrate a good example, then the mage lords of the kingdom will be viewed as valued assets, not troublesome liabilities. As I said, Penny's cousin smiled and bowed, uncommonly noble for a nobleman.
He's still new at it, Penny sneered. Don't worry, by next year he'll be as jaded as any old baron. Is that eel on the buffet?